extremely difficult. This splash pad would be so much more than an additional amenity. It would create another accessible opportunity for children and families to enjoy the park together, especially during our hot summer months. This splash pad isn't only an investment in the lives of our kids and their families, it's an investment into all of Atascadero. Families from our communities and surrounding areas will come here specifically to enjoy Joy Playground and the splash pad. Those families will visit our restaurants, shop at our businesses, buy gas, and spend money in our city. This has the potential to be a tremendous community asset and an economic benefit to Atascadero. I know there has been discussion about changing plans for this space, a space that has been reserved for Joy Playground for years. I have heard ideas and plans that would go against everything that Joy Playground stands for, and the inclusivity that our community deserves. As you can see, our community cares about this cause, and we are here to be a voice for those who may not have one, and to advocate for our families and for the inclusivity for our families. The need for inclusivity is growing, and so is Atascadero. Our children have waited long enough. Our community has worked too hard, and we have a plan and a space that have been set aside for this purpose for years. Our families are showing up, and it is time to rally. We are asking that the City of Atascadero recognize the increasing need for this project and come alongside us and work together to find a solution that allows the splash pad to become a reality. Our kiddos deserve this. Our families deserve this, and I believe that the City of Atascadero deserves this incredible investment as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, please.
There we go. All right. Hello, Mayor Bobo and council members. My name is Molly Kern. I'm the CEO of the Slow Food Bank and really grateful for a few minutes of your time this evening to talk about Hunger Action Month. So every September, nationwide Hunger Action Month campaign unites millions of people across the country to raise awareness and provide nutritious food to our neighbors facing hunger. In Slo County, where our Slo Food Bank network is currently providing food to 50,000 neighbors every month, a 58% increase over the past 5 years, this means inviting you and everyone in Atascadero to join us in raising awareness and recognizing the thousands of local residents who help feed Slo County every single day. Right now, our Hunger Relief Network reaches over 14,000 people each month in North County alone. This tremendous impact is only possible because of a collaborative network of over 70 other nonprofit partners who distribute food directly within their own neighborhoods. And in Atascadero, this includes the incredible people at ALF Food Pantry, the Boys and Girls Club, ECHO, the Link Family Resource Center, and even your Atascadero Library, where we'll be next Wednesday for one of our monthly distributions. Our mission is made possible by the profound generosity of our community, with more than 70% of our organization's funding coming directly from local individuals, businesses, and foundations. We are so honored to be this community's food bank and be a true reflection of the generosity that's at the heart of Slo County. Together with the hard work and dedication of over 1,300 active volunteers who generously give their time to nourish their neighbors, we are honored to provide this compassionate, nutritious hunger relief to more than 1 in 6 county residents right now. If you're ever interested in learning more, I invite you and anyone who's here tonight to come by for a tour of our warehouse or to consider volunteering at one of our neighborhood food distributions to see firsthand the tremendous difference that a nutritious meal can make. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to speak? I'll have a few comments about the food bank at the end here. But go ahead, please.
Good evening. My name is Jessica Puccinelli, and I'm here tonight to ask the City of Atascadero to consider adding a fully inclusive splash pad next to Joy Playground. As a mother of two autistic children, a 5-year-old daughter and a non-speaking 3-year-old son, our family faces unique barriers to community participation. Because we live rurally, in-home OT and early intervention is not an option for us. Instead, my son's therapies take place in public spaces like Joy Playground. During our extreme North County summers, where temperatures routinely exceed 100 degrees, outdoor therapy at 1 p.m. is impossible, leaving us with a critical gap in our public options. While the county does operate a splash pad at Heilman Park, its design creates clear safety barriers. Both of my children tend to run away or elope. and an unfenced water feature next to a parking lot and a roadway is an immediate safety hazard. Additionally, the water features are intensely overstimulating. True accessibility requires more than a standard ADA ramp. It requires a thoughtfully designed environment where children with different sensory and physical needs can actually participate. Joy Playground is the perfect opportunity to establish a new standard for inclusion, joining other forward-thinking cities like Temecula. Their Margarita Park splash pad utilizes safe, zero-depth water play and zero-depth zones to accommodate diverse physical and developmental needs. Clinical research shows that water play is uniquely beneficial for autistic children, providing gentle sensory input and natural resistance that significantly improves their motor coordination, emotional regulation, and social communication. Furthermore, an inclusive design serves children with complex medical needs who are entirely shut out from traditional parks. For example, one mother shared with me that her child has a tracheostomy and cannot use typical high-velocity splash pads due to respiratory risk. A low-flow, sensory-friendly water feature would finally give this child a safe place to play and belong. Our local community has already demonstrated a massive demand for inclusive accommodations. Recently, Colony Cinemas began offering sensory-friendly screenings, lowering the movie volume and leaving the house lights turned up for people with sensory sensitivities. The overwhelming turnout month after month proves that local families will consistently show up when safe spaces are provided. Financially, the project allows Atascadero to tap into the rapidly growing accessible tourism market. By following the model of Greater Palm Springs, which became a certified autism destination, to capture a major travel sector, we can draw driving distance families who will buy gas, eat at our restaurants, shop downtown, and maybe spend the night at our hotels. Ultimately, though, this is an issue of equity, not economics. I want my children to grow up knowing that their community made space for them. And that's what I'm asking you to consider tonight. Not just building a splash pad, building a place where children like mine are expected, welcomed, and included. Because our kids are already part of this community, I hope we can build something that shows them that they belong here. I'm asking the City Council to view this project not as an optional amenity, but as a necessary investment in the safety, inclusion, and well-being of all of our children.
All right, thank you. Do you have another speaker?
My last splash pad.
All right. Thank you for that last comment, and thank you for your comments. Anybody else wishing to speak, please approach the podium.
I'm Mona. Good evening. My name is Tanya Porras.
You can bend it down if you'd
like. Thank you.
Thank you.
Not that low. Good evening. My name is Tanya Porras, and I want to ask you, how many times have you heard your kids saying, "Mom, Dad, I'm bored"? Not much to do for our kids in our area compared to big cities. At least they have access to parks and the Ravine Water Park. Our children with special needs do not have that many options. Please support a splash pad for our special needs children. A splash pad will help building language skills, motor skills, and social skills. Every child deserves a place in our community to have fun and to feel included. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Good evening, Council. Jeff Oslin, once again, resident of our fine city. I have a fiscal question that I'm going to raise for our council and our city staff. Now that we're getting notices in the mail from 3CE with a comparison of PG&E, I think it's time to find out if we're saving money by being with 3CE or not. The last 2 years, I've noticed by the comparisons that most times now, it's actually costing more money to be with 3CE, and I think it's something fair for our residents to really know when they get the postcard and read that, which they probably won't, but I've gotten three of them now, and I can tell you, for me, I'm better off now with PG&E rather than 3CE for whatever reasons. The other one I'd like to discuss is, being that we're looking at a bid, I'm very concerned on the AMR bid. And the reason I'm going to say that is there was two fire trucks in front of City Hall with an AMR ambulance taking photos with our fire department. So it looks like it's a done deal, and it should not be that way. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your comments. Anybody else wishing to speak in community forum? Okay, seeing none, I will close community forum. I would ask that folks really consider supporting the food bank and its partner agencies in Atascadero, like ALF, or formerly Atascadero Loaves and Fishes, and the other partners that she mentioned, because they do a great job, and they really deserve to our support, whether that's volunteering or financial. And so I thank Molly Kern for coming out tonight and telling us about Hunger Awareness Month, and solicit all of you to help support them. Mr. Lewis, there were multiple speakers tonight regarding the idea of the splash pad. I'd like you to at least to address where we're at in terms of park master plan and the prospect of a splash pad.
Sure, and it's always nice to see articulate parents getting out to speak on behalf of their kids and a young citizen. That's good. So where are we? So yeah, I think that we've known about a splash pad desire. I think one of the first things we do want to do, there are a lot of requests from the community. And so the council last year asked staff to begin the process of a parks and recreation master plan, which looks at all of our facilities. And so we wanted to get through the general plan and zoning code, which you're about to do next month. And then we will have that on the agenda to discuss and kick off, and staff will have some concepts and ideas at the strategic planning meeting of the council early next year. So what that will look like is identifying areas in the community where we could expand parks. So what properties are available for future park facilities? And then within our parks, how are they programmed? Are they programmed to the best capacity? And are there new facilities we should look at in each of our parks? And then we would put costs by each of those things. So we actually can look 10 years into the future about where all of our priorities are. And as you do have a dollar to invest in parks, where you prioritize it. So we'll start that discussion in February. That will likely go through June, July. And I think that will be a great opportunity for parents and others to bring forward their requests and needs. I think one thing I did want to reiterate that I've learned is when the Joy Playground, which is a terrific facility, was built, much of the plumbing, we did install plumbing for a splash pad there. That was envisioned, that dirt spot next to the Joy Playground years ago, to potentially be a splash pad. That was largely removed and made dysfunctional. So building a splash pad there would be starting from square one. So then the conversation is also, is that the best place? It very well may be, but that's part of the thing we'll go through as we look at the Parks Master Plan. And we're looking forward to working with the council and the community on that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lewis. All right, we will proceed now to the next item, which is item G1, a public hearing regarding Community Facilities District Annexation, number 27 for Barrel Creek. I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Dunsmore to present this item.
Thank you, Council. And I'm actually going to hand this over to Eric Gomez, our planner, who's going to tell you about the CFD basics. But I also just wanted to throw in there about this really important project, and the applicants are here tonight. This is one of the very first stages of developing a site with housing and mixed use, and we're really looking forward to the next steps for this very important project on this vacant land that's just off of Del Rio. So take it away, Eric. Let's hear about the CFD.
Thank you, Phil. Good evening, Council. My name is Eric Gomez. I'm the Associate Planner here at the City of Atascadero, and tonight I'll be presenting for a public hearing on the Community Facilities District annexation of the Barrel Creek project. That's annexation number 27. So let me take you all back to 2023, great year when you, in your wisdom, approved the Barrel Creek development. The project was overall a mixed-use master plan development, which included 20 single-family residential lots, 40 apartment units, a 120-room hotel, 16 short-term cottage lodging units, and a 53,500 square feet proposal for commercial tenant space over a series of retail buildings, which included some event space and an internal plaza area. The project site is located just west of the intersection of Del Rio Road and Highway 101. And to bring you even further back to 2005, when City Council adopted the Community Facilities District 2005-1. And so essentially, you all requested to promote fiscal neutrality in our city when it came to mixed use and residential projects. in particular towards the residential component, you said we'd like to have projects where we can get returns basically on the services being extended to our growing population, and that's in particular for emergency services and park services. So through that creation of that community facilities district, we began conditioning projects requiring discretionary approval to be fiscally neutral through the annexation to our facilities district, which adds a line item to their annual assessment rules, where they see an additional fee charged per residential unit on that property. Now, just this year in June, the council adopted an intent to annex the Barrel Creek project. So you can see the boundaries of that project on your screen now. Essentially, with that resolution, you said, hey, we are aware of this project, we are aware of what this property is, and we will be considering this for annexation. Staff went ahead and took the annexation map from that hearing to the county recorder's office, and we filed it with their clerk as required by state law. And so now we are here at the public hearing where you are all looking at formally adopting their annexation or approving their annexation. Now we always have this slide up because this hearing process is a little funky or out of the normal. And so just this slide basically just explains how this hearing works. So as you all just did, you will open the public hearing for this item. Once I'm done with this presentation, and I believe after I answer any of your questions, you'll close out the public hearing and consider Resolution A, which is establishing the annexation of the territory described there, the Barrel Creek development. Once the hearing is closed, you will all actually take a short recess, and that recess will allow for our landowner election for annexation into the recess. They do have to vote to annex into the district. Our city clerk, Lara, will be acting as the she will be announcing who how the election goes. And our once we have that election or those results, our city council will certify the election, introducing for first draft reading draft ordinance A, authorizing the special taxes for annexation number 27. So with that all said, we have our recommendation on the screen, listed in four separate items. The first one is to adopt draft resolution A, authorizing the territory identified in your previous city council resolution 2026-055 to be annexed into our community facilities district, and authorizing the levy of a special tax and submitting the levy of special tax to qualify leaders. And after doing so, directing the city clerk to conduct a land owner vote of annexations and collect the ballots, which I believe she already has. And then you will go on with 3 and 4 as written on your screen.
Okay, thank you. Can you back it up to the process slide just so we can all follow along? I think go back one more. There we go. Okay, does any member of the council, first we're gonna see, does any member of the council have any questions for staff? Okay, because I have one, but go ahead.
Yeah, just in your presentation, you mentioned that that this is about the annexation of the property. And I just wanted to clarify that that this is property that is already in the city limits, and we are not annexing property to the city. We are annexing it into the community facilities district specifically.
Exactly. That term is a little bit confusing. It's definitely in the city, and we use the term annexation for these community facilities districts just like we would for annexing property from the county to the city, which is not the scenario here. So thanks for asking that question.
Okay. Thank you. My question is, could you go back to the map? My question is this. The parcel in the lower right-hand corner is not part of the Barrel Creek project, correct?
That is correct, and that's separately owned.
It's separately owned, but it is part of this CFD annexation based on the map.
I don't think that's part of the CFD annexation. I don't think that would be accurate to say that.
Okay, it looks like it's included here on the map is why I'm asking. And if so, I'm assuming that that means at least one additional property owner, if that were the case. So is that just a kind of error?
Yes, that was an error. The boundaries that I highlighted were everything that was included in the entitlement, which included that small, at the time, a small cluster, which was your short-term rental cluster, the lodging units. But what's being annexed right now is the stuff that's under single ownership, so it excludes that block
okay.
rent parcel.
Got it. All right, thank you for that question. Okay, we're, this being a public hearing, we're going to go out to the public and see if any member of the public would like to comment. Okay, I'm sorry, we have a question for Councilmember Peak.
Thank you, Eric. So just for clarify to the public that we're annexing this into community facilities district, meaning that we have a developer who's actively pushing forward with this project that's been highly anticipated for years.
That is correct. Yes. And the applicants are here tonight too, if you'd like to ask any questions about their future plans.
Oh, no. Well, I assume the plans have not radically changed from what has been previously approved by council.
Nothing has changed as of today.
Okay.
There's discussion, okay. But nothing's changed.
Okay, so but I don't think we need to spend time doing that. We thank you for coming, though, and following the process. Is there anybody wishing to speak on this item at the public hearing? Okay, Mr. Osland.
Thank you. Just one quick question. After the annex, and I did see it in the presentation that it will be a separate district, would say like any of the others that come before this council every year. So that would have their maintenance fees if this project is built out in that special district in addition every year. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else wishing to speak? Okay, seeing none. To be clear, this is not for maintenance. This is for the provision of city services that the, so it's not for maintenance. Maintenance, I assume, would be handled by a separate either assessment district or homeowners association or what have you. Correct, Mr. Dunsmore?
That is correct. This is not for maintenance. And so that would be a private property issue.
Got it. Okay, thank you. All right. Seeing no one else, I'm going to close public comment and I guess therefore close the public hearing, and we will bring it back to council. Go to the last slide, which showing the last step, and I'll bring it back for council discussion or motion.
I am delighted to see this project moving to its next stage, and would, unless there's council members looking for discussion, I would move that we adopt draft resolution A as proposed and direct the city clerk to conduct a landowner vote of annexations and collect and count the ballots.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion by Councilmember Funk, a second by Councilmember Newsom. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom?
Yes.
Councilmember Peak?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Daris?
Yes.
Mayor Bobo?
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
Okay, so we will take a brief recess. Clerk, how long do you estimate it'll take you to count those votes?
Can I have 30 seconds?
Okay, well, okay. You can have more than that because we're going to take a 5-minute break. And so we will be, it is 7:23. We will be back. Let's make it 7:30. Nice even number. Thank you.
AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM, Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton. Tonight's City Council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230 KPRL.
It was the most powerful weapon ever unleashed in wartime. An agent of overwhelming destruction that helped to end World War II and ensured that a third World War would yield no victors at all. The first successful atomic bomb was developed in secrecy by a team of U.S. scientists under the command of Major General Leslie Groves. When the first test explosion occurred in the pre-dawn light in the New Mexico desert on July 16, 1945, Brigadier General Thomas Farrell told Groves, "The war is over." Groves replied, "Yes, after we dropped 2 bombs on Japan." Within 30 days, both men's prophecies came true. At that time, plans were underway for a full-scale military invasion of Japan, an assault that was certain to cost the lives of many thousands of American soldiers. The astonishing power of the atomic bomb suggested that an invasion might not be necessary. "It seems to be the most terrible thing ever discovered," wrote President Truman in his diary, "but it can be made the most useful." Hiroshima, a city on the southwest coast of Japan's main island, became the primary target, due in part to its large military population. Just before 9:15 on the morning of August 6, 1945, three U.S. B-29 bombers, the Enola Gay and two escort planes, flew over the city and dropped its cargo, a nearly 9,000-pound atomic bomb. 30 seconds later, that bomb exploded 1,850 feet above Hiroshima in a blinding, searing flash of light and heat.
The White House has just made an important announcement on the war. And to bring you this story, we interrupt our program to take you to Washington.
I have just returned from the White House, where it has just been announced that the United States is now using an atomic bomb, the most powerful explosive yet developed. At the White House, Eben Ayers, presidential press secretary, released a statement by the President of the United States on the atomic bomb. Here is President Truman's statement.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
The damage inflicted was almost beyond imagining. Heat ranging up to 7,200 degrees Fahrenheit instantly vaporized the center of Hiroshima, and most of that city's buildings were reduced to char and rubble. An estimated 80,000 people died within the hour, more than a third of Hiroshima's civilian population, while tens of thousands of others would perish from burns and radiation poisoning in the months to come.
Tonight's City Council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Welcome to Heroes of the Air, true stories of those who flew for America and earned the nation's supreme military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Heroes of the Air is brought to you by the Air Force Association, an independent nonprofit aerospace organization which promotes public understanding of the role aerospace power plays in our national defense. Your host for Heroes of the Air is Gene Pell.
After 2 days of continuous attack by numerically superior North Korean forces, the U.S. 24th Division had vacated the town of Daegu and was retreating to the south toward the port of Pusan. It was only on the sea and in the air that American and United Nations forces were dominant in that bleak summer on the Korean Peninsula, near Hanchang, Korea, August 3, 1950. Air Force Major Louis J. Sabil was with the 67th Fighter Bomber Squadron, 18th Fighter Bomber Group of the 5th Air Force, when he distinguished himself by conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty. During an attack on a camouflaged area containing a concentration of enemy troops, artillery, and armored vehicles, Major Sabil's aircraft was severely damaged by anti-aircraft fire. Although fully cognizant of the short period he could remain airborne, the Air Force Major deliberately ignored the possibility of survival by abandoning the aircraft or by crash landing, and he continued his attack against the enemy forces threatening the security of friendly ground troops. In his determination to inflict maximum damage upon the enemy, Major Sabil again exposed himself to the intense fire of the enemy gun batteries and dived on the target to his death. The superior leadership, daring, and selfless devotion.
Tonight's City Council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
It was the most powerful weapon ever unleashed in wartime. An agent of overwhelming destruction that helped to end World War II and ensured that a third world war would yield no victors at all. The first successful atomic bomb was developed in secrecy by a team of U.S. scientists under the command of Major General Leslie Groves. When the first test explosion occurred in the pre-dawn light in the New Mexico desert on July 16, 1945, Brigadier General Thomas Farrell told Groves, "The war is over." Groves replied, "Yes, after we drop two bombs on Japan." Within 30 days, both men's prophecies came true. At that time, plans were underway for a full-scale military invasion of Japan, an assault that was certain to cost the lives.
I believe it is 7:30. And if we could go back to the slide showing which step we're on. And we'll go to the clerk and ask, has the clerk counted the votes?
I have.
And would you tell us the results?
And the results are, it passes.
Okay.
All in favor.
All in favor. Okay. So in that case, we are ready to move on to adopt draft resolution B, I believe. Correct? Okay. So do we have any discussion or a motion to adopt draft resolution B?
I will move that we adopt draft resolution B and introduce for first reading by title only the draft ordinance as in the staff recommendation.
I okay. Second.
All right, we have a motion by Council Member Funk and a second by Council Member Peak. Roll call, please.
Council Member Funk?
Yes.
Council Member Peak?
Yes.
Council Member Newsom?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Daritz?
Yes.
Mayor Bobo?
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
The key is don't make a motion, then put something in your mouth. Okay. All righty. And let's see, no further actions on this item is necessary, so we will move on to item H1, Management Report, Comprehensive Zoning Code Update. And it looks like I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Dunsmore, our Community Development Director, who is probably going to hand it off.
Can we, one second, can we back up? Councilmember Funk, was your motion for the draft resolution B and the ordinance, or yes?
Okay. Yes,
thank you very much.
Introduced for first reading by title only, the draft ordinance as specified.
Perfect. Just wanted to confirm. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Dunsmore, and I see Kelly Gleason waiting in the wings.
Praise blots. Good evening again, Council, and this is one of the final phases of our general plan and zoning update project. Tonight is our final, I'll call it a check-in on the zoning. It's our last chance to sort of give comments. We can't make a major departure at this point, but essentially what we're going to be looking at is some last-minute policy discussions and asking for some direction from Council tonight on several topics. We do have our consultant online as well, Genevieve. She's going to chime in and tell you about the process a little bit and where we're going. And then Kelly and I are going to go over some of those specific policy questions we have for you. And our plan is, and I'll tell you about this a little later too, is to return with a finalized document, take it to the Planning Commission, and bring it to City Council in October for final action. And just a reminder, 2 weeks from now too, we'll also be taking, hopefully taking final action on the general plan and its environmental impact report. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Genevieve. I hope she's online. I hope we can get a seamless transition to bring her on.
Good evening. Can you hear
me? There she is. Hi, Genevieve. I can hear you loud and clear. And Kelly's going to operate the slides. And are you able to see the screen, Genevieve?
I do not see it yet.
You don't see it yet. Okay. Well, just in case you don't, we're on the back.
There we go. Now I see it.
Now you see it. Wonderful. Technology. Love it. Thank you. I'll let you take it away from here, and I'll be back speaking in just a moment.
Great. Thanks, Bill. And good evening, Mayor Pro Tem, Council. Thanks for having me here tonight. When we started the zoning code update last year in 2025, we identified 5 main goals. The first is to achieve consistency with the general plan, both the place types and the policies within the general plan. And this is really the bulk of the substantive changes that are proposed for the zoning code. The zoning code is a direct implementation action of your almost there new general plan. So it translates those new general plan place types into zoning districts. We might have multiple zoning districts within each general plan place type. For instance, we've got 4 mixed-use zoning districts, 1 mixed-use place type, but we also were able to simplify some existing zones, zoning districts. So we used to have 5 commercial zoning districts. The proposed zoning update has just 2 commercial zoning districts. So the second objective is to really make this as user-friendly as possible. We want transparency and predictability. So the key thing that you'll see is a total reorganization, hopefully into a much more logical order, and the addition of just really clear language, making sure that each item is only in one place. So if you change it later on in one place, you don't have to remember to change it in another. And just using really clear language, adding tables to make things clearer and graphics. Third, we build on the work that you've done over the last few years to streamline processes. So building on the objective design standards and the CEQA thresholds work, this zoning code update includes more process streamlining efforts, including looking at ways that we can get more projects reviewed at the staff level and increase that review speed and reducing costs for applicants. Fourth, we are implementing City Council direction on some specific items. Phil and Kelly are going to cover some of those tonight. And finally, we are updating certain parts throughout the code scattered to address new and evolving state laws. So we've been working on the zoning code in parallel with the general plan for a while now. Preliminary work was done in 2025, including a general plan open house where we also had some zoning context there where we previewed the place type and zoning code district translation. And throughout the first half of 2026, we reviewed some additional substantive changes through study sessions with the council and planning commission. We started out by discussing entitlements and some of the administrative processes with council back in February. In March, we talked about the new mixed-use zoning districts and what standards and uses would be allowed within those through 3 study sessions, 2 with council and 1 with planning commission. And then in the later part of the spring, we looked at commercial uses and the commercial zoning districts, especially the new commercial innovation zoning district through a study session with council and planning commission. So we took all that feedback and developed the draft that you have in your packet tonight, and we're looking forward to discussing a couple individual topics with you. So the 8 key topics that we're highlighting for your review that we haven't dug into in previous study sessions. The first is a discussion about minimum hours for retail businesses. We'd like to discuss some changes to the emergency shelter overlay zoning district. This is just to implement state law requirements. Parking standards, so we have new consolidated land uses, and so now the parking standards to meet those. We had to do some dovetailing to get all of those to match. Review authority for design review, looking at streamlining the review through administrative use permit for certain land uses, an update to the native tree ordinance about dead trees, looking at multifamily zoning districts and allowing certain flexible uses to help foster complete neighborhoods there, and finally removing some restrictions for outdoor amplified sound downtown. So I'll turn it back over to Phil to dig into some of these.
Thank you, Genevieve. And this one picks up on some council direction we had from some time ago that we should look at, you know, if a retail use has a closed door and is doing mail order or some other type of business, are they considered a retail business or should they be called something else? It's not whether they're allowed or not, it's whether how they're categorized. And this has been a question that we've kicked around quite some time. And the discussion here tonight, the recommendation here, is to have a requirement that has a regular amount of minimum hours, and we're only talking about the downtown. Of course, their option is this could be applied elsewhere. But what we're saying is if something is in our downtown and it's classified as a retail land use, then it should have open hours. If it's classified as a mail order or it's classified as an office or classified as something else, so be it, fine. And if it's allowed in that district, then that's okay. I don't think we're saying it shouldn't be allowed. But what we're saying is just for retail. And so on the bottom there is this proposed definition, which says the general retail uses in the downtown commercial zoning district must maintain regular posted hours and be open to the general public for walk-in patronage during those hours for a minimum average of 20 hours per week. Retail uses operating exclusively by appointment will not satisfy this requirement. So before I keep going with these items, I probably should have asked the mayor prior to this whether you'd like to talk about each one of these items as we go through them, or go through them all and talk about them, come back to the ones you have questions on or take discussion.
Generally, I think it'd be better to just talk about each one because they're substantially different from each other.
Sure, they are, exactly.
So I think it'd be good to talk about each
one. Let's go ahead and pause here, and then I'll take council questions. And
the audience is small enough so that if we allow public comment, I don't think that's going to be too disruptive. So.
Yes, thank you.
If we allow public comment on each one and get repeat comments, that'd be my only concern. So, okay, thanks.
Do you want me to proceed with my questions?
You want to, that's all, you're done with the presentation?
For this particular item, this item one out of eight, I'm done with my discussion on this
we'll
one. I'll be happy to take some questions.
Introduce them with questions. And my first question, though, for anybody is, I'm going to go to the public works man and ask, is there a way to cool down the temperature in the room here? It's getting pretty hot, and I don't think I'm the only one who's noticing that. Nick? Is there any way to cool the room down?
The air did just turn on, Mayor Burbo.
Okay. Yeah, got it. Thank you.
Usually much colder.
Go ahead, Councilmember Newsom. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I have some questions in regard to the DC zoning district. Do you have a map of that? And while you're looking for a map, I'll ask my questions.
Yeah, we can try and pull one up from.
Okay, outside. Just as a guideline, I know that we've had several boutique establishments, and then a lot of small businesses are ran by one owner. And so what I want to know is, how does that apply when they have a sick child and they decide to close for a week, or they have, you know, a family emergency? How is that going to affect them?
That is completely different. Any business might close to go on a holiday or a vacation or an illness. That's not how this is defined here. Just on a general basis throughout the year, does the business generally stay open, or they permanently have a closed door where there's simply a mail order or storage? And we have several of those businesses downtown now, and they're legal. They're legal non-conforming, but should they be called retail, or should they be called something else? That's really the question here. So not just about someone closing for a week or even 2 weeks if there's some issue, such as construction or illness or vacation.
But what if somebody chooses due to a family issue, medical concern during COVID? We had a lot of that, and people went to private appointment only, but they are retail. How does that affect?
And I think for a nationwide pandemic, everything's off the table. Very different scenario. Or for some other circumstance, that's not what we're talking about here. I think what we're following up on here is what we had heard from council is, can we look at a way where in general, outside of a pandemic, outside of a critical issue such as an illness or vacation, can we have some standard for normal open hours? And maybe it's not a number. Maybe there's another criteria we could think of. And I think tonight we're just looking for your direction on this, and this is not a have to. And this is something, if you wanted to table it for later, we can. I'll bookend that by saying there are a lot of other amendments that will continue needing to be done to the zoning over the next year or so. We're going to have to come back to you for short-term rentals, for example. We've got other state law things to implement. We're doing a pretty good job by fixing the zoning now, but we're not fixing everything right now. But we do want to kind of catch these last few policy discussion items as we move forward.
Okay. And then the color on the map, which one is the DC zone? Purple.
The nice red.
Red or purple?
Or, sorry, is it?
Fuchsia?
It's zoomed so far out. It's a deeper brick red color.
We put the cursor on it so we can, okay.
Yeah. That's what I thought. So it's
thank you.
That area with the two little alleyways. You can see our alleys between Entrada and Traffic Way there.
Okay. Any other questions? No, I mean, Councilmember Newsom.
That was it. I was just mostly concerned about, sole owner retail and then private by appointment only outside of pandemic. I think some people adjusted their business models due to some constraints, both personnel issues and also with choices of quality of life and life balance. Right. So,
okay. Thank you. Councilmember Funk.
Yeah. First of all, now that Anna has moved her wonderful shop out to the Valley Fresh Market, are there other retailers that are doing the same kind of appointment-only model right now downtown?
We're not aware of any others that are currently doing that model right now. There are some businesses that have very, very reduced hours and they work sort of on a hobby basis. That's really the question here. Going forward, we're in a transition right now and our downtown is really becoming successful. We're seeing a lot of new restaurants, new development. A lot of it spurred from the downtown enhancement plan. So we're thinking as we move forward, how do we want to manage a retail use in the downtown compared to these other types of mail order or office uses?
Yeah, this is something that's been kicking around for quite a while in discussions in the years I've been on the council. Has it been the subject of any outreach in the last several months to the downtown business owners now in downtown or through the Chamber of Commerce?
We have not done that.
Okay. Is that something that could be accomplished before this moves forward?
So
we have
time.
Not trying, because it's all the difference in the world between supporting downtown business owners in the work they are doing themselves to create an environment where they support their businesses, support each other, and us coming in with a heavier handed minimum that we haven't discussed with them. So I would look to see staff engagement downtown.
I talked with Ms. Capel today. She has had obviously informal conversations, not to the degree you're asking. And there is interest in creating more traffic and more energy. We could certainly do a survey next week, a simple e-survey to the business assessment district to see what level of support there was for something like the 20 hours and get that information back to you.
That would meet my concern. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mayor Pro Tem Darris.
Yeah, comment and maybe a question here. When I first read this on, the idea of required number of hours that a business would have to be open, I thought that was like, wow, can you really do that? And then I realized that it is a good idea in the downtown. If you're not going to be open for very many hours, you probably should be in a different area of town. That would be fine. And then I'm going to go at a harsher end of this. It's funny because I'm kind of going, but that doesn't mean I'm advocating for what I'm about to say. But I thought about 20 hours a week seems reasonable. Typical work week is 40 hours a week. But a business could be open from 8 to 6, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., and only be required to be open 2 days a week if 20 hours. So if we're trying to maximize the activity in downtown for businesses, is 20 hours enough? Is it reasonable to do that? I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is a new thing to me to consider something like this, but like you had just mentioned, downtown is bustling now. It's getting more and more busy. Businesses are seeing a lot more activity. But I don't want to, I'd hate to make a decision on a number of hours that might hurt us more than it would help us. So I don't know if 20 hours is necessarily the right thing, but I'd like some feedback from you on
that's it's a great topic. You know, typical hours would be 30 to 40 for a business. We're being feather light. We're being very nice here. We're being very flexible here for a start on this. I think that staff's approach, can we start moving in this direction? You know, someone can get 20 hours done in 2 days out of a week. You're right. Should we go further? And so this is up to council as to how we would want to move forward with this. And again, it doesn't prohibit other land uses. It just if you want to be called retail, this is what that is. It's a retail land use.
I mean, could we can we mix the idea of saying, you know, 20 hours a week or a certain number of days? So, I mean, that might be open 3 or 4 hours a day, but 5 or 6 days a week, or if it's 20 hours in 2 days, then maybe that's acceptable. It could be one or the other. I just think that, you know, if you want the downtown to be bustling, a business being open 2 days a week or 3 days a week is not going to get you there. I'm just concerned about that.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Beek.
Yeah, just want to comment. Anna & Company is open for browsing now at our new location, so make sure you check it out. Just for the record there, it's a beautiful store. If the downtown is bustling, people will want to be open longer. I think 30 hours, even with 2 days off, is 6 hours for the 5 days. A clothing store from 11 to 5 is a pretty standard hour. You know, we do have retail mixed with restaurants, and we do see restaurants on Entrada that are closed Monday and Tuesday or just Monday, depending on the place. Those are typically those slower days for those smaller businesses. I'm perfectly happy with businesses deciding when they're closed, during what days they're closed. I also don't think it's a hurdle. 20 hours is like a big softball. I don't want to promote people having dropship companies or direct mail companies in downtown Atascadero, even if they've changed that way. I mean, obviously they can stay there. They're nonconforming, but in the future, it's great for foot traffic to have businesses that are encouraging foot traffic. And I'm not the minimum hours requirement, I don't think is going to be a big hurdle for most businesses. They want to be open more than 20 hours a week to be viable. Now you're talking about restaurants, it might be a little different having Mama Taro being open for 3 hours serving great ramen. You know, I wouldn't want to make them stay open longer just to satisfy some sort of need. But you know, I don't think 20 hours is hard to ask of people, and I'm open to discussing more, but the days requirement, I would be absolutely against forcing people to be open on certain days.
Okay, thank you. My question is this, do other cities do this that you're aware of?
I don't know, but we want to be the first.
Well, I mean, I think we agree that the downtown is much more thriving than it has been in the past, which means, you know, property values and lease costs are up, I assume, which means businesses inherently have an interest in staying open longer to make the money to pay the rent or the mortgage, right? So, I mean, it's sort of a self-solving problem. As the downtown becomes more thriving, businesses will want to stay open more hours, and, you know, there'll be the traffic there to support them. Would that be a reasonable assumption?
Yes, it is reasonable. It is reasonable assumption. I'm sure other cities do this. Honestly, we haven't done that research. This is one that we haven't plagiarized. This is one that we are.
Because I mean, about. Part of me feels like we shouldn't be telling a business what to do on this. But it is detrimental to neighboring businesses if a business is hardly open, you know, and people have to walk by closed doors in order to get to the one that's open. You know, that doesn't promote a thriving downtown. So certainly willing to look at it. I would kind of agree with Councilmember Peek's comments that 20 is not a very hard thing. I guess my concern is if you don't do this, you could have somebody, you know, setting up something that is just nominally a retail place, but really is, you know, focused on just, you know, being a fulfillment center for whatever product they carry, because they meet some very minimal requirement to be called a retail establishment. And I know we have some establishments like that in downtown that are no retail, you know, like in the old Bank of America building, not the one that's closed, but the old Bank of America building on Traffic Way, you know, that is a non-retail business. But someone like that could, in theory, you know, open their doors for a few hours a week and call themselves a retail business, right?
If someone's selling goods to the public.
Yeah.
Yes.
Got it.
That's the concern.
Okay. Got it. Okay. And yeah, I think it's unusual that someone like Anna, I think based on reputation, was able to make it as a by appointment only business. But it probably wasn't helpful to the neighboring businesses to, you know, to not have people be able to walk down the street and walk in the door. So, okay. All right. Thank you. We're going to open it to public comment.
So I'm not sure regulating is a good idea. I'm not sure it's not. You have the Haunt in the downtown. Is that retail? They're not open but a few hours here and there. I just kind of look at it that way, but let's go another example. We have about 12 places in the downtown, which we call restaurants right now. What happens if a restaurant or two go out of business and it's vacant and somebody wants to come in with a high-end wedding cake bakery or a cookie bakery that is by appointment only, or they ship out? You've just eliminated a spot that has hundreds of thousands of dollars or a couple hundred thousand dollars of commercial space for a restaurant that can easily can be converted to a bakery or a commissary and still gives the city tax revenue, but they're not, their doors aren't open. And as a personal, my bakery in Boston is not open to the public. We only ship all over the country and the world.
Thank you. I would clarify, though, that this, we're talking about retail establishments, not food establishments, not service things like the chop shop or, a music place or something like that, correct?
Yeah, those other things have separate definitions. Okay. So these for example, someone who you know, has a bakery or a sausage maker that's not open to the public, they're going to be called something else. But also, those wouldn't be allowed in the downtown on the ground floor anyway. So this is just about downtown and just about the retail category. Obviously, a restaurant category.
Okay.
Needs people.
Got it. Okay, so bringing it back to council then, it seemed I saw a consensus that 20 hours is not unreasonable. A little concern about telling businesses what to do, but this is a pretty minimal soft touch requirement. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, I do want to see that the conversation happen with the downtown business owners, and I would not... I do not think we're ripe to take this citywide.
Right. Now this we're talking downtown only, and I think so. I think you hear where we're at, but I think it is a good idea that we reach out to the, through the Chamber of Commerce,
yes,
or to the Downtown Business Association,
yes,
and see how they feel about that. So, okay, all right, let's move on to the next topic.
All right, this is one we have to do. We have some changes to state law as a result of Senate Bill 340. And essentially what it does in summary, that when a shelter has a series of activities, all those activities are considered part of the shelter operations. Right now, we have a conditional use permit that was required for a meal program and a shower program at our homeless shelter. We cannot do that anymore. We have to allow those as part of the shelter operations. However, we can still regulate and enforce the management standards through the existing operations and management plan. Now, the guidance for the operations and management plan is in our municipal code, but the actual operations and management plan is a separate document that the council reviewed at one time, and then we see an annual copy of it, but there's not been any changes to it since they did the expansion. Now, what I will mention, what I did find in the code, just for example, there is a limitation on the number of hours that's in our municipal code that the shelter can be open. But the reality is that section of the code, and I'll show you that. This was a comment that was brought up. I have it in the end here of the presentation. There it is. This is one of the items.